Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales and Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Morning, Amy.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm glad you got my microphone on today.
Yes, there you go. See, I was getting towards the end of the week. I'm starting to get into the groove now. Come Monday, I'll be out of the groove and doing everything wrong again. Yeah. Michael Aird joining us today live in the studio. Michael's a... he's a director of the company here, Beamer, director, been a director of the company for quite some time, a number of years. Michael Aird is also has a degree in anthropology. He's a publisher, he's a curator, and he's a man of many talents. You see him around, he's always got the camera, always flicking, flashing. Welcome to the program, Michael. How are you?
Hi, Tiger. Thanks for having me here, and hi to Amy.
Who's your mob, your country?
We're from the Gold Coast. My mum's mother came from the Southport area, the Graham family from the northern end of the Gold Coast. Her father was Stanley Uke from the Bedezet area. And my father's family, my father's parents both came from Scotland, but they settled on the Gold Coast over 100 years ago. So really strong connections to Southport and that whole broader area.
Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
Born in Southport and grew up in Southport.
Really? A proper Southport boy?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So a lot of time fish and crabbing and all this sort of stuff that a lot of people can just have memories of. You're still doing it sometime.
I still go out crabbing a bit.
Yeah, bought me in a crab a year or so ago. It was lovely. Yeah, man. So, all right. Well, this would have been a very, very different Gold Coast, Southport, back in those days. Very different.
It certainly was, but I mean, in some ways, I can still see the same sort of little town that it was. It's still underneath all the buildings and everything. There's still a lot of the locals are still around, and that's the thing for our family. You know, we were the main large Aboriginal family on the north end of the Gold Coast, and we'd been there, you know, forever basically. Particularly going back to about 1880 when my Aboriginal great grandmother and my non-Aboriginal great grandfather. Settled in Southport. My great-grandfather was the harbour master or river pilot was his correct title at the time. Settled at Southport. So he was a public servant with a good job. And our family have been, in Southport ever since. And so we've had that whole networking of, connections and we've survived.
Well, what about the population of Murrays, generally speaking, our mob there in the Gold Coast area? Was there many families there when you were young growing up? Just your cousins, your family, what?
Generally, just people, relatives. There was there's a few Aboriginal families, a few South Sea Islander families as well on the coast. But it's a lot more families have come in since then, back then obviously we all knew each other. And I think the whole Gold Coast has changed, from a whole racial makeup, It was there wasn't many non-white people on the Gold Coast when I was young, but that's changing now. It's certainly a lot of different races and different groups who are coming in, so certainly the makeup's changing.
Mm. And you're an anthropologist. Why did you decide to get into anthropology?
Well, I got interested in the mid-1980s my first interest was sort of archaeological sites and I had a real interest in that and went to university at University of Queensland. I started in 1987 and I really hell-bent on being an archaeologist for a short while, but after a couple of years at university I just lost interest in the archaeology side of things. And at the same time, this love of photography was just growing. I just absolutely loved taking photos, looking at photos, old photos, any photos. I just loved working with them and starting putting them together. And so I think my sort of interest in archaeology fell away and this love of photography just grew. And I didn't really plan to, be an anthropologist. It was just that I just wanted a university degree and I worked hard to get one. I knew really to survive as a professional in this industry, I just realised the importance of a degree. And so, anthropology was just, you know, what I ended up with.
So those photos, taking photos all the time, I mean, we can mention a family name to you and you can say, yeah, well, I know that family line, I know this and know that. You're almost like a historian.
Yeah.
You are, from where I'm sitting anyway. But the photos that you took over the years allowed you then to be curating or led to this curating of exhibitions and things, did it? Or is that something different again?
Well, no, it's all the same. It's been really 30 years and through photography it's how I've earned a living. And it's history, you know. I guess, you know, historians may look at, you know, letters and government documents and other people use all, other professions use all types of methods to, you know, to do what they do. But for me, I just look at photos and think, well, what can I learn from that photo? How can I use that photo in a book or an exhibition, or how can I share that photo with other people? And, you know, I start with, you know, to me, yeah, history starts with the invention of the camera, as far as I'm concerned. That's the way I see the world.
Do you think there's a difference in the way Aboriginal photographers take their photos or view these images compared to white photographers? Because I just think of that famous photo of Vincent Lingiari and Gough Whitlam, and there's the famous photo by Merv Bishop. But there's another one and it's completely different. Like, it's from a different angle and it just, to me, it says different things. Like, do you think, what's the main importance of Aboriginal photographers? Do you see a different way of looking at things than white photographers might when they're photographing our people?
Well, I think it's just every photo just has a story, and once you know the stories, like that photo you're talking about by Mervyn with Gough Whitlam and Vincent Lingiari, that actually wasn't the official photo of the day. There was an official photo of the handover ceremony happened a few minutes before that, but it was under a bough shed. And the light wasn't very good. And I know Mervyn, he's told me this story, how he then said, right, I want to reconstruct this photo. So he took them outside and got them with the sun behind, took the photo, and now it's one of the most famous photos in Australia.
Yeah.
And as you said, the other photo, that was actually the official government photo of the official handover, no one's ever seen it.
No, and it just doesn't have that power and it doesn't say as much as what Merv Bishop's photo says about land rights. So I just thought it was really interesting. We got you here today to talk about a commemoration on the Gold Coast, and it's a really important, it was a repatriation in the 80s of all these 150 Aboriginal remains on the Gold Coast. Can you tell us a little bit about when those remains were found? But first of all, how long were the remains there unnoticed?
Well, this is an important story, particularly for my family, but going back to the 1965... the story started where these soil contractors were literally going out into the bush behind Broadbeach and digging soil from an old ancient sand ridge and spreading it around people's lawns, you know, delivering it around the Gold Coast for topsoil. And then people started finding bones appearing in their front lawns. A local non-Aboriginal man called Scott Derrick, who was a journalist and he knew, had connections with Aboriginal people, so... he was known as having an interest in Aboriginal history. So he was contacted. He contacted the authorities, which in turn that the police were involved and then the University of Queensland became involved.
What did they think the bones were from first? Did they think it was something modern or did they have any understanding this was an Aboriginal burial ground?
Well, they had to go through the process of, you know, obviously, is it a murder or where are the bones? Identify it. And they did that process and they actually tracked down, well, they spoke to the trucking company, where did this soil come from? So they took them out in the bush and showed them. And then once they'd sorted it out, the University of Queensland organised for Lila Hagland, who was the only qualified archaeologist in Queensland at the time. She came down and started an excavation. But poor Scott Derrick, you know, he was quite disturbed about the fact that all these eventually ended up being nearly 200 remains.
Really? And they were stretching back from, like, there are 1,000 years old in some cases, weren't they?
Yeah, well, once the excavation was all done, it was identified that the burial ground was constantly being used from about 1,000 years ago right up into the late 1800s, and there was evidence of, like, rabbit bones and cow bones incorporated into traditional Aboriginal burials. So it's an amazing story.
So this was an ancient burial ground. Did your family have any concept that it was there? Was there any knowledge that this burial ground was there?
I think it's an aspect of our family's history that, you know, living through decades of government intervention and fear of, you know, having children removed or whatever, it was part of the conservative culture. You know, our family kept things like that quiet. You know, I know a lot of my uncles and grandfathers' generation, they've all worked in the earth moving business, and I know they were well aware that these bones were all over the Gold Coast in different places. This isn't the only burial ground.
But there was no mechanism to, I mean, when you think of our remains being destroyed and damaged like that, at the time there's no mechanism to protect these burial grounds, was there?
No mechanism, no law at all, and that's why I was saying Scott Derrick did his bit to try and stop the excavation from happening. He worked with some of my mum's cousins, and there was letters written, but there was no protection. The government, I guess, at the day decided that the best protection would be to remove them to a university.
So they removed 1,000-year-old remains, 150 of your ancestors' remains, and stuck them in a university, in the anatomy department.
That's what happened, yeah. But then bring it forward to the early 1980s when you know, everything was changing for Aboriginal people. People were starting to get strength and some political power for the first time. And this was an example where our family, I guess, had kept a very low profile as far as, you know, a public identity, you know, talking about Aboriginal rights and issues up until that time. And it was actually the discussion about these almost, you know, 150 to 200 remains sitting at the University of Queensland that really prompted our family as a group to come together and unite and say, well, you know, we are the traditional owners of the Gold Coast. How can we want those remains returned to the ground? It's our responsibility to see that happen. Mm-hmm. So it was a very important political step for us to make.
Yeah.
And also in an international sense, not many communities in the world had been involved in this sort of political activism up until that time.
When you sought to get the remains back, what was the response from the university? Was it a bit of a fight on your hands at the time?
I think there was people not happy about it. And there was certainly people worried. I think in some ways it went relatively smoothly for us. I think, you know, they'd been there a long time, they'd been studied. But certainly on an international level, there's academics to this day still fighting, you know, wanting to draw a line in the sand saying these remains should not be returned. They're too valuable to science.
Wow, that argument between science and, you know, the right to have your remains back. They've, like, remains become like nothing, you know. They don't become human beings or they're relics.
So the argument, it was, certainly was at the forefront. I think we were fortunate that it did, you know. It took a few years, but you know, the handover was given from a legal sense. They agreed to do it. It took another couple of years to secure a control of a park. And then I think even there was a drought at the time, and so we knew once the land was cleared and the remains were returned, we couldn't plant trees or anything for a couple of years because of this drought. So I think that held it up by about a year or so. And then it happened in 1988. We took the remains back.
How did it feel to rebury those remains in 1988? What was the ceremony like?
It was very simple. There was quite a few of us there that all helped. I think we made a point of not involving the media and not making it a big public spectacle. It was quite private. I was actually the one that helped, one of the ones that helped physically remove them from the university into a hired van that I drove. And so I was the one that I had actually the remains in my front yard overnight.
And oh, then, wow.
And then
wow.
drove down the next day.
What was what's happening now? Because you've got a commemoration on the Sunday. So what's it commemorating, or what are you planning to do on the Sunday?
Well, this Sunday at the Gold Coast and Hinterland Historical Society, which is just at Bundahl at the Behind Surface Paradise, we've invited lots of people. We've got quite a good lot of people coming. And I guess importantly, we've actually got the archaeologist, Lila Hagland, the archaeologist that was involved in the excavation from 1965 to 67. She's coming to talk about what happened. So
she's still around.
She's still around. Yeah. She's still in good health. So
we're getting on a bit now, wouldn't you? If she worked in 65 on this. Well done. Great.
So I think we're very fortunate to have her here. She'll be talking for an hour on Sunday morning. But I think from the discussions I've had with her, she wasn't really happy with the whole concept of them all being removed. I think she would have preferred that they were kept in the ground, but the protection wasn't there from the government. And then she was one of the main people that also lobbied the Queensland government to help develop a Aboriginal protection legislation or a heritage legislation.
Do you think it's strong enough now, looking back? I mean, it's never going to be perfect, but how would you describe it in the current day?
Well, there's been a few. This first legislation was introduced in 1967. I think the next major legislation that was replaced in 87, then another in the current legislation was introduced in 2003. So it's a very contested argument, but I wouldn't say I'm a fan of the current legislation, but it has its flaws, but it's all we've got. So, there's some good people administering that legislation trying to protect sites, but they're up against them very, well-funded developers that will fight to make sure that Aboriginal culture doesn't get in the way of their developments. So it's a very, very contested area.
You mentioned before the international arena. After you got these remains returned to and buried again, you actually went overseas, didn't you, in 1989? I mean, what was the sort of reception overseas to something like this happening? And you said it's probably one of the largest repatriations in Australia at the time and even on an international scale.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking nearly 200 remains, so it was very large. I think there was only other, at that time in Australia, I think there was the cow swamp repatriation in Victoria, and I'm not sure the exact numbers, but I think it was, somewhere close to 100 or so, but no, a lot less than the number that we had returned. 88, the remains are returned, and then 89, I was fortunate to be invited to a conference in Vermilion, South Dakota, organised by the World Archaeological Congress. And the name of the conference was Archaeological Ethics and the Treatment of the Dead. And it was the first major event internationally, getting Indigenous people together and archaeologists in the same room. And there were certainly some heated discussions at that event.
Yeah, it would have been.
And we travelled with people like Les Melzer, Bob Weatherall, mm-hmm. Badger Bates, Jimmy Everett from Tasmania. Mm-hmm. So... A few of us from Australia were there. Gordon Briscoe was another one there. And it was talking about really this whole debate between Indigenous beliefs and science. And we were fortunate to have an organisation like the World Archaeological Congress, which have always been very progressive and very committed to seeing human remains returned. Other academic organisations and haven't been so supportive.
We're still seeing that. It wasn't that long ago that the Tasmanians had a big fight on their hands because the London British Museum didn't want to... They were going to repatriate all these Tasmanian Aboriginal remains, but they wanted to test them first. We're still having this debate. I mean, has anything progressed since then? It doesn't seem to.
Well, as I realised in 1989, internationally we were one of the first, very few communities in the world had had this success. So it was amazing to realise that we'd achieved what we had
did.
As a large Aboriginal family to achieve what we had achieved at that time. And the debates are still going on. Still Indigenous communities around the world are still fighting with institutions.
That's right, they are. Yeah.
It's sort of like an undercover racism, isn't it? Because it's sort of prioritising that Indigenous knowledge below Western science. It's almost as if Western science is seen as paramount when, 70,000 years of Aboriginal history is just sort of wiped off the table as if we know nothing.
Yep, and obviously, and some people don't think that contemporary Aboriginal people should have any say, over the control of this aspect, important aspect of history.
What comes of these studies? I mean, are they coming up with anything? What are they looking for? What's the result of these studies?
Well, quite often, I guess, as I said before, I lost interest in archaeology a long time ago. If I was a practicing archaeologist, I'd be saying that incredibly wonderful information is being secured. But again, for me, I'm more interested in the more contemporary side of history. I'd rather just see the remains in the ground.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't have dates like 40,000 years at Lake Mungo without these types of excavations. So, there's important information getting secured, but it's still,
Is there some news on Mungo Man? He's being taken back?
Yep, I think only in the last week or so. Yeah. After incredibly long decades of being studied, finally being returned.
And finally taken back to country.
You mentioned on the Gold Coast there are other burial sites. Is there knowledge of where they are and are they similarly protected?
There would still be, there's not much of the Gold Coast that hasn't been developed, but there's potentially still, human remains sitting under places. In fact, the Historical Society, where we're meeting on Sunday, was it's on an ancient sand dune, and you can still see, you know, it's this high, sort of high section within what was once a very large swamp. I mean, half the Gold Coast was a big swamp once.
Yeah, yes.
And within that big swamp, wherever there was high sand ridges, or ancient old sand dunes, there's potentially burials, because that's where the preferred place was. Some were in caves, so places like Nhumbunbar Valley to the west of the Gold Coast, burials were in caves out there. Places like the middle of Southport, the very stretch of road where we're having the meeting on Sunday, that remains right within kilometres of that, like right next door, the property next door, there was bones.
Right.
And even the Historical Society is sitting on an old sugar mill cemetery. There's still some headstones there, and there was apparently hundreds upon hundreds of non-Aboriginal workers, probably South Sea Islanders, and traditional Aboriginal burials and middens, all in this site. So it's only one little pocket, one little bit block of land that's still protected, and the rest has all been developed by units and roads and businesses.
How do you see the way sort of Australia views white heritage to that sort of black heritage?
It's a hard question. I work in history and I know that the mainstream community have a really strong interest in Aboriginal history and culture. But unfortunately, you know, some people go to theme parks for those versions of history, you know, and they're accepting of whatever rubbish they get told and often overlook, you know, the important role Aboriginal people have played in certain aspects of history. Instead, they go back to sort of dreamtime stories and aspects of history that can be romanticised. And I guess archaeology plays a part in that. People love talking about what happened thousands of years ago, but don't, you know, and then skim over the incredibly politically important stories of what Aboriginal people have lived through in the last 100 or 150 years or so.
Mm. So you're very focused on modern political history. How did you get into that?
I think it was really, my upbringing of growing up as an Aboriginal person, but from a conservative, you know, family that just conformed with the mainstream community. And then as I grew up, starting to realise that there's aspects of Aboriginal culture around me, you know, and I just got really interested in, you know, just the history of my family. So sort of anything to do with my family, I'm interested in, and that spreads out to every other Aboriginal family in Southeast Queensland.
Family grows, the extended family. Michael, with some 150, I think you said, remains being relocated, how is that done? It's a separate little... I mean, there's a whole lot of planning. There's probably ceremony and words to be said and stuff. But when there's a number, big number like this, I'm trying to envisage what is it? Have you got 150 holes in the ground spread around? How does this happen?
Well, essentially, there was a large hole, and we did our best to actually place them roughly in the order that they were dug up. So there was some, you know, order to the way we put them back, because they were each identified as individual people.
Right.
And that's where I think the number sort of changes a bit. originally, when Lila had finished the excavation, I think she identified somewhere, I think, in the low hundreds, you know, 110, 120 or so, actual different people. But over time, when those bones went to the university and more analysis, they started to realise that the numbers of actual different individuals grew, you know, to somewhere, I think, closer up towards 200.
Right.
So I'm not sure the exact numbers. They're somewhere between 150 and 200.
Mm.
We did our best to try and put them back, you know, roughly in the relationships where they were originally dug. I mean, there was a lot of ceremony and thought went into how these people were buried.
And there has to be. If you're going to do justice and do with the proper respect and everything, that's got to be done. Mm. Yeah. And there's difficulties when you're dealing with mainstream people, university people and what have you. Sometimes there's conflicting views because they don't understand our ways a lot. There would have been a few discussions and a little bit of arguments or debates along the way, I'd imagine, even amongst your own mob. What was it like?
I think everybody... I think the first debate was, you know, why us? You know, why are we getting involved in this? And I think the main thing was we said, well, we are the traditional owners of the coast. I mean, we someone has to do it, and so we better step up and do it. So that was the main thing. And I think once the decision was made, I think there was no argument. We just, everybody could see that these people needed to be returned to their country.
Yeah, good one, eh? Yeah.
And you were saying before that this event actually politicised your family, but also led to a lot of other changes, didn't it?
Yeah, I think even just myself as an example, you know, here I was, you know, quite young at the time, getting involved in this, you know, watching, you know, the older relatives make these decisions and write letters and do the lobbying. And so I was just there, you know, playing a small part in the whole thing. But it gave me confidence, you know, that, you know, I can, you know, I want to work in this area, you know, portraying Aboriginal culture. I want to, you know, be involved. It gave me a real, I think professionally, a lot of confidence that, you know, we have an important story to tell our family, and, you know, and I'd like to tell that story.
So it sort of led you into photography as a medium to tell that story?
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I guess, you know, the early 80s, I just started with my first camera that I got off my mother, and, you know, she, my mother was always a good photographer, and she gave me some basic tips, and I just started taking photos. And then I think it was that whole thing of actually starting to file the negatives away, and then start thinking, well, this, I'll just keep, you know, I'll just start looking after these and just adding to this. So all of a sudden it was like a collection, and then it became like a pretty serious collection, and I just...
The other kids, other young people might have been collecting stamps or something or other, coins or whatever. Here you are collecting negatives of photos from around amongst your mob.
And I just started, you know, writing the dates of every photo, you know, and names of people, and then going into libraries and photocopying more old photos, and, you know, and now it's just grown. There's photos everywhere on the internet. There's photos on Facebook. There's, you know, so I've just, now I'm still, so I developed systems where I can now just deal with just continually basically making copies of photos and referencing them, and then whenever I'm doing a project, I can draw upon, you know, 30 years of research and essentially, so have you got a photo of so-and-so, I can find
great,
them.
How great's that?
We were looking through some of your photos before for a new exhibition you're doing, and there were, like, photos from Warrabinda and Mornington Island. Do you ever go back to those communities and see how they've changed and seen, do you know what the main changes are, or can you see it in the way you've, photographed it?
Well, yeah, that's I love taking photos back to communities and showing people, you know, and, you know, photographing little kids, then finding out that now they've got kids, and it's, so I've really been privileged looking back at my photos and seeing, you know, whole families grow and develop, and, yeah.
But it's more than that. It's like, I guess you chronicle how little things have changed, but how things have changed as well. So I think on the one hand, you've got certain photos where nothing might have changed, which is really sad, but on the other, and you can sort of see how Aboriginal policy, I guess, has changed for over those past 20 or 30 years you've been doing it.
Yep. And even particularly looking back at my family's history, I look at, because of the politics, because our family, you know, in the early 1900s, lived, you know, were generally in fear of government coming in and intervening with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They worked hard. I mean, they had to work hard. They had to work hard to show survive their successes to the European society. So they worked hard, they bought good clothes, they had photos taken. And in the early 1900s, walking into a photographic studio or buying a camera, you know, in the later decades, it was a luxury. And a lot of white families didn't have that, didn't have the money to get photos taken. But I look through our family, we did. You know, our family were working hard, earning money, getting involved in photography from day one. In fact, I can name one Aboriginal family from North Stradbroke Island who have a photo in their family that was taken in 1873.
Really?
And that was their, you know, their great-great-grandmother walking into a photographic studio in Brisbane as a paying customer in 1873. So Aboriginal people have been using photography, you know, for political purposes for a long time. And that's what I see in, I see in our family photos, well-dressed, confident Aboriginal people. And they were, they were looking well-dressed and confident for a reason. You know, there was politics behind that. Yes. So I love looking at that. I love looking at the photo of my grandfather in about 1930 with the bullock team that he owned. And a few years later he sold the bullock team, I think it was 1933, and he moved to Southport to be with my grandmother's family, and he bought a truck. And he used that truck to shift dirt and gravel and rocks around the Gold Coast as a contractor. He owned that truck, you know. And I look at those photos and I'm really proud. So, and I guess that's what I'm trying to do today with my photographic work. I like documenting the successes and how proud Aboriginal people are of what they've achieved.
There's a lot of strength that's not shown in a lot of other journalism or photojournalism. I think, like, sometimes I think white journalists go in there or white photojournalists go in there and just want to show poverty and everything like that. But I think that's the difference. With Aboriginal photographers, you often see the humanity in the photos.
Well, it's the motivation, I suppose. What's the purpose of taking a photo? And with a white journalist and stuff like that, generally it's to do a story and try and paint as negative a picture as possible. Whereas with your family and stuff, it was more about capturing the moment, the people and stuff. Different reasons for taking a photo.
And different reasons for using it now, I think, as well.
Yes. We might take a break for a song and come back. I'd like to talk about your book that you've got, you're working on a book now. We'd like to talk about that. You've got a couple of other people involved with you there. But here's a song by Vic Sims, and it's called Stranger in My Country. Welcome back to Let's Talk. That was Vic Sims, Stranger in My Country. And a lot of us know that feeling, being a stranger in your country. But then again, you only got to look through the haze and the smoke and the crap and you'll soon see, you know, stranger in your country is your country, and you stand up and hold your head up and take control. Assert your rights as a sovereign person, as a First Nations person. Michael Aird is our guest live in the studio. Michael Aird has a degree in anthropology. He's a publisher. He's a curator. Takes a lot of photos. And he's an amazing man to sit down and talk to and work with and stuff. It's just amazing the what's in his head and the photos that he has. Michael, you must, thank God for the digital era. You're able to, storage isn't such an issue. But the reason I say that is I visited old uncle quite some years ago. I remember his name soon. And he had one little room. It was just chock-a-block photos, photos. Victorian man.
Alec Jackamos,
old uncle. Yes. Yeah, it was amazing going into his place and seeing a room that was just chockers with photos. And they were old stuff. And I'm talking, this was 30 years ago then. He would have handed them over to somebody, I suppose, bequest them or whatever into some sort of a statutory body or...
I think, I remember
what
meeting
people, what do you do with these sort of collections?
Yeah, Alec was a real inspiration. He was a non-Aboriginal man, a Greek man.
Imanani Moore.
But everybody in the Victorian community, I believe, you know, had a very high opinion of him. The work he did, he documented families, he took photos. He came to Brisbane as well in Stradbroke and he toured with the boxing troops.
That's right, he was a wrestler.
And whenever it was nighttime, he'd go stay with the Aboriginal families and meet people and take photos. And so he did a brilliant job. So when I was, I think, just really getting serious with the work I was doing, I fortunate to meet Alec and really inspired. So I think he's definitely encouraged me. And I know some of his photos are in the Aboriginal Institute in Canberra. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's probably, you know, collections in some of the institutions in Victoria as well.
All right.
You're telling us before you've done 5 books in this year alone. How do you do that?
Stay with us.
Yeah, I've done 5. I've published 4 books this year and one more about to hand over to the printers today.
Right.
So I've got...
On what topic, sorry?
So, yeah, what have I done this year? So I think the big book I did this year was working with Gary Foley and Edwina Howell in Victoria, documenting the history of the memories of Barry Dexter, who was appointed in 1967 in charge of the first Aboriginal federal department.
Federal department.
Harold Holt appointed him, and then Harold Holt died soon after.
Disappeared.
But for the next 10 years, he worked with Nugget Coombs and Professor Stanner. There were a 3-person committee overseeing this department. He was the administrator. And it's an incredible story of the work that he did. He's still alive, Barry, lives in Canberra. And with Gary Foley as the main driver to make this book happen. So I was I took on the job to get this book published, and it was a massive book.
Oh, it's bigger than the Bill Gammage book. It's just a big book.
There's letters and correspondence and all types of memos. Barry just put so much effort into this, and it was sitting in Canberra, unpublished, the manuscript, but Gary was the one that met with Barry.
Mm-hmm.
They became friends, even though back in the 70s... Barry Dexter, I think, was in fear that he was going to be assassinated by
I was going to say Farley. They wouldn't have been happy. They wouldn't have been friends in the 70s.
and Barry had, federal police protecting his family because of the fear of radical Aborigines.
Mm.
Does that come out in the book about, was there anything in the correspondence about this fear of radical Aborigines at the time?
No, there's a lot in this book. So it was good, to see Barry and Gary at the opening in Canberra. I didn't attend, but I've seen the photos. It was a wonderful thing to see them together and to see this story, such an important story. So
you're the publisher of that book.
So as a publisher, it was hard. It was hard work dealing with such a big book. It was 9 months' work.
Yeah, such a book with so big. Where did it go? What do you do with that sort of a book? Are people out there wanting to buy that? I mean, and what sort of price would you? What does it sell for?
Well, it being so big, it's actually the retail price is $150, and libraries are buying it. That's the important thing. Once it gets into libraries, they'll look after that book. And it's a
I'm borrowing Tiger's book. I probably won't buy it, but I'm going to borrow it.
I'll bring it in. It's a company book. It belongs to the station. I've got Auntie Lil Watson on the line. Auntie Lil, welcome to the program. We've got Michael Ead in the studio live, as you've heard, and Amy McGuire. How are you?
Oh, thank you. Look, I'm a bit worried about the time on the phone. I mightn't last long, so I'll try to talk as fast as I can. I got on late to the program, and I heard Michael talking about the reinterment of the skeletal remains that were found there. I was working at the university in the 80s, and it was very quiet. Nobody knew anything about these bones. Then someone came to me and told me that students were using those bones in their medical studies and in experiments and that, and I could not believe what was happening. And I was so angry. I wrote to the vice chancellor and said, if this practice didn't stop and acknowledgement of it made public, then I would go to the press and publicise this. The vice chancellor said that he would look into the matter or something to this effect. I was so angry. I went to the Aboriginal students. They had their meeting, and I told them about this, and I asked for their support and some action, and not one of them supported me. And I tell you what, these Aboriginal students, they're big, high-profile Aboriginal people now. Not that I'm trying to name them and shame them, but they know who they are. And I'm still very upset over what happened to these remains, these skeletal remains that were being used like that. And I went on strike from the university, and as a form of protest, and I would not teach in that university while those bones were being treated in such a disrespectful manner. And so my students were wonderful. They followed me off campus because I continued to teach what I was my courses off campus, and my students were wonderful. They all followed me because the social work department at that time had a house off campus, and I was able to continue teaching from this off campus location. But I want to say my the students were just absolutely wonderful. They supported me and came to my lectures off campus. And until that acknowledgement was made, and put out a press release saying that the remains were there and being cared for and something else.
So they dragged their feet a bit, did they? They dragged their feet a bit with this demand that you placed on them.
Oh yes. Yeah. I was off campus for weeks. Mm. It could have been 3 or 4 weeks. It might have been longer. I don't know.
Well, they tried to work out how they were going to deal with it.
Yes, and anyway, finally there was a press release, and that's when I came back onto campus. But I was very upset that I received no support from the Aboriginal students that were on campus at the time. Mm. It was very hurtful to me. And you know, they're really big, high-profile people. And I just thought I could have received some support from them, but I never, ever did. Yep. But yeah, that's all right. I mean, I don't condemn them for it, but I was very hurt.
Yeah, and, of course, disappointed.
Because disappointed and very hurt, but it was so upsetting for me to learn about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's what I wanted
you.
To say.
Thank you for that contribution. Yeah, no, it's good to hear from you.
Thank you.
All right, Aunt. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We were very lucky to have people like Auntie Lilla supporting us at the time.
Yeah.
And she mentioned the press release. I remember the day when that press release came out. And
true.
That was like the turning point.
Did you have any understanding that was happening, what Auntie Lilla was saying about the medical students?
I wasn't aware of... I knew Auntie Lilla supported and was involved. I didn't know about the having to go off campus and how upset she
going
was.
Going on strike and stuff, yeah.
But I knew she was supportive and I knew the word was getting out amongst the university.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no debate, you know, amongst Aboriginal people. There was no debate. Everybody wanted to see them returned.
Mm.
But, I think what I got from Auntie Lilla then, it was so traumatic and it just adds to the narrative of dehumanising us because it's saying those bones are nothing.
Yes.
When they're people, they're ancestors.
Exactly, our ancestors.
And I can understand how traumatic it is.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Bye, G.
And Auntie Lilla was right, you know, they were being studied right up until the repatriation. They were, you know, students were using them, you know, so they were just treated as objects.
Yep.
Yeah, treated as objects, treated which is how objects. It's been this whole time, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's upsetting. It's very understanding and understandable that Auntie Lil's so upset as she is. Quite upsetting, yeah.
So can you tell us a bit of details about the commemoration, just so we let our listeners know if they do want to go and pay their respects to these remains on Sunday?
Well, it's at the Historical Society and it's... The main aim is to hear what Lila Haglund has to say about both the excavation and her role in helping draft the first sites protection legislation in Queensland. There'll be lunch served, and then after lunch we'll have a 1.5-hour session where Dr. Steve Nichols, who now works administering the current legislation on behalf of the state government, Professor David Trigger from the University of Queensland, and the archaeologist from the Gold Coast City Council, Kevin Rains, and my relative Haig Best, who's the Indigenous Sites Officer for the Gold Coast City Council, will be all joining. Well, the audience, everybody in the audience can ask questions, and we'll be discussing all the implications, exactly things like what Auntie Lilla was just saying, and acknowledging all the different people who contributed to this whole, both events, the original excavation and the repatriation.
So that's on at the Hinterland, Gold Coast and Hinterland Historical Society, 8 Elliott Street, Surfers Paradise, this Sunday, 11 to 2:30, and the cost is $25.
That's it, yeah.
If you want to get along.
And how can people, there'd be a contact number, do people need to, register their attendance in order for catering and stuff like that?
Yeah, turn up on the day.
All right, yeah.
Just getting back to what we were talking about, Pandora's Box, about Gary Foley's book, when you look at that, you obviously know every dot and dash in that book. When you're reading through a lot of that internal correspondence in the department at the time, do you see a lot of changes to how Aboriginal Affairs was run now, or were there any key differences, do you think?
Well, I think you see it in the book that, and Tiger mentions this all the time on radio, about how urban Aboriginal people were largely overlooked back in the 70s.
Yeah.
But I think Barry Dexter had some foresight. He was starting to acknowledge urban Aboriginal people when all the previous bureaucrats hadn't.
Mm. Yeah.
So, and I guess that relates to our family as well. We were one of those, you know, Aboriginal families that were not, you know, drawing attention from the government. But it's sort of, you know, and I think going back and interviewing Ross Watson for my book Brisbane Blacks, he was summing up the political era of the Commonwealth Games in 1982 and how there were protests, incredibly well orchestrated, organised protests. And Ross explained that really at the end of that protest period, you know, all the protesters basically said, we've achieved something good here. We've succeeded in getting our message out to the world. He goes, now we can move on and do other things like start radio stations and get degrees in anthropology and whatever and theatre and, you know. So I think I'm of the younger generation, and thank elders like Ross and that were before me. They did the really hard yards of getting Aboriginal people recognised. And then I'm from that generation where in the mid-1980s I had the opportunity to go to university, and Aunty Lilla was one of those people that paved the way for me to get into the University of Queensland. So now 30 years later, I'm you know, very grateful with this wonderful career I've had working in Aboriginal arts and history and culture. But it's thanks to that, you know, that I was very fortunate to be of this generation where these opportunities opened up to me.
Yeah, for sure.
And we're having the Commonwealth Games soon on the Gold Coast, which is the roundabout. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any protests then, but I think it's a bit different times, isn't it? But when you're talking about urban policy, Ren, I was just thinking it's gone backwards if you look at that, because we're in a situation where Aboriginal policy is still very much focused on remote Australia.
Yeah. No, I think we have to protest. There has to be a protest. Again, we want to show, like, the whole world is watching. That was one of our catch cries. The whole world is watching. The whole world will be watching again. And we are in a worse situation than we were in 82, I believe. Worse situation as far as policies go and treatment of our people, the stealth of our children, the suicides, the incarceration rate. I mean, you can just name whatever it is, anything. And it's worse than what it was in 82, I believe. So I've been talking about it for a while, saying there's got to be protests.
I'm all for protests.
Oh, got to be protests. There has to be. It's on our doorstep.
Well, did it happen as much in Sydney Olympics? Were there a lot of protests when that was happening? Or?
No, because it was largely a Queensland thing, you see.
Oh, okay.
There wasn't that much down there, but people in New South Wales were up here supporting and come up and camped. Musgrave Park was tent city. It was amazing. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to Gold Coast Olympic Games and hoping to be down there. It will be there in some capacity, reporting, protesting, or both. Yeah, a lot.
Well, a lot depends on how Aboriginal culture is portrayed at those games. If the organisers do a good job and involve the right people, there might be, you know, a lot of people nationally very proud of the story that gets told, or there could be people quite embarrassed of the story that gets told, depending on how it is organised.
And it always has to have ownership in Aboriginal hands when you do these sorts of things, so hopefully they get it right on the Gold Coast.
Yeah,
but hopefully. We'll see. Hopefully. The jury's still out.
We're getting close to time, Amy. Michael, it's good to have you in.
Thanks, Tiger and Amy.
No, it's really, really good yarn. It's great. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, and get out to the Gold Coast and Hinterland Historical Society Sunday. If you'd like to learn more about it.
Get down there. A contact number. Amy, is there a contact number there? Anybody?
It's Michael, so I don't know if he wants to give out his contact number.
No, they can call the station. They can
just call the station.
Call the station.
And I'll put the details up on Facebook as well.
Right, sweet. Here's Bob.